Blog Talk Radio.
Sports Conversation. I'm Don Henderson. We've got our normal group of guests along the way. We hope that you'll stay with us and maybe we can get some information to you and maybe we'll learn a little something for people that are going to be joining us on the show. Roy Cummings will start it off in just a couple of moments, but our executive producer, Frank Carroll, has a dedication he wants to get to first. Frank? Frank?
Yeah,
Frank.
I'm here. Yep. Will Rogers had said that you'll walk through life and you'll meet thousands of people. You'll keep 100 feet for acquaintances, but you only keep less than that for friends. And one of those friends passed away last night. A lady who was, she walked through life not caring what anybody said, not doing anything improper. She was the mother confessor to probably 100 priests in the Diocese of Wilmington, a wonderful friend and family member, Marie Bumball, passed away last night. On the other hand, there's some good news. We have a good friend, the sheriff of Hillsborough County, Chad Cronister, had been asked by the president to head up DEA. And for good reasons, Chad has not looked at it, came back and wanted to stay here. So we're glad to have Chad back as our sheriff. He's run twice now unopposed. He does a great job, and we salute him. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Don.
All right, Frank, thank you very much. We'll go to Roy Cummings down in Tampa, Florida. Roy, you and Frank, I just want to do like a minute or so just to wrap up on what's happening with the Rays and going down to Steinbrenner Field in Tampa to play this coming season. So we got so much to talk about tonight, but I just want to wrap it all up, Frank, and you know what the votes have been and what's going to happen.
Well, as far as
go ahead, Frank.
That's okay. This was a long one that I try to understand. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, this thing is still up in the air. I mean, nothing's been solved. That's for sure. There's just a lot of finger pointing going on. They haven't really reached the deadline yet. I mean, they're going to play in Tampa in 2025, but you know what goes on. What happens? The biggest question now is what happens beyond that. And there's no, you know, there's no clear cut decision on, you know, how they're going to fix the TROP, whether they're going to fix the TROP. Whether they're going to build a new building now, everything that's still to be determined. So, you know, it looks like they're set for 2025, but it very well could be the Rays' last season in Tampa Bay.
You know, right? the president of the Rays had sent a letter to the county commission after the last meeting, saying as far as he was concerned, they didn't live up to their obligation, and he felt that that this deal was dead. And he extended another deadline for them to try and get something done. The problem comes down to the fact that they had a lot of support. There are a lot of people that don't go to the games, that watch the games on TV, that did support some of the politicians who voted for the new stadium. Unfortunately, those guys were voted out this time. So they lost a lot of support there. One of the most harshest critics is Chris Latvella. Chris is vice chairman of the Pinellas County County Commission. And he and the chairman both sent a letter to the Rays saying, look, you're not coming up with anything here. You want us to expend $625 million in bonding, and you want the city to do the same thing, but it's a $1.3 billion project that we haven't seen you do anything. They sent one back and said, look, we put $50 million into the architectural drawings, to this, that, and another thing, but yet, as I told you in the very beginning, no soundings have been done on that land. No purchases have been done on that land. There's no way in hell that's going to be ready in 2028. So at this point, they could be going anywhere.
Well, let's leave it right there. If something comes up in the future, we'll go to it because a lot of sports news to talk about tonight. And, well, we've gone up and down with the Buccaneers. We'll start with you, Roy. You're right there in Tampa, Florida. And, of course, the Bucs had a big win this last week after a couple of very tough losses. And at the same time, the Falcons and Rodgers in Atlanta. So we'll go to you first with the Buccaneers. And it looks like down the South is coming back to another race.
Yeah, it's definitely a race, no doubt about it. Kind of almost a little bit of a, you know, battle of attrition, really. But, you know, who can last out the other one? It's not the prettiest football, that's for sure. It seems like, you know, neither team is – obviously taking command of this division. But I'll say this, the Bucs, you know, won a game this past weekend where they did not play their best football. All of a sudden, Carolina, you know, seems to be a viable opponent. You know, they gave Kansas City a game 2 weeks ago, gave Tampa a game. They'd won a couple. So watch out for Carolina going forward. The Bucs have them one more time. So, you know, they've got their antenna up for sure. And it could you know, have a lot of meaning because, look, I'll say this. I've said it, you know, I think we all realize this. The sign of a good team is when you win, when you don't play your best football or whatever sport it might be. And in this case, the Buccaneers did that. They did not play exceptionally well, not play, you know, well on, in any phase, really. And yet they won. They found a way to win, and that's what matters most. So it's on to the next one, and hope that the Falcons, who I'll turn it over to Roger, continue to, you know, help the Bucs out by losing winnable games against beatable teams. So you know, it's again, it's like, who wants this division right now? It's hard to tell who wants it most or who's going to get it because both teams have had their struggles at times when you wouldn't think they would.
Roger?
Well, I'll tell you. The Falcons, that's why I was very suspect several weeks ago. I said, I want to see what goes on in the next few weeks. And they're playing the Vikings. Now, that's going to be a game for Kirk Cousins because he's going against his old team from last year. But I do not see the Falcons really looking good. And I don't expect them to win, and I think they're in a free fall. The thing that really concerns me, I guess, more than anything is I want to see the coach with some life on the sidelines to try to get some energy. And I haven't seen that with Raheem. I mean, you know, great coach, could be a great coach, but I have not seen that. And I think it does take some life sometime to really get charged up out there and get the players psyched up and everything. But I'm not real confident about the Falcons, the way they're playing. I don't expect them to win this weekend. And I think, you know what, Roy, you hit the nail on the head as far as I'm concerned. The Panthers are the team of the future. They've got the quarterback, the long-term quarterback. He's really turned it around after he got benched. And the team is looking really good. And I think, what are they, 2-3, I think, because they lost. 2-3 since they made a change. So I think that they are the future. They've had good draft picks, but I'm not happy, and I'm not confident with the Falcons.
Roy, you can say pretty much the same thing about the Saints. They play one real good game. They surprise you and win a couple of games, and then they play a sneaker like the other two. So how about the Saints? What do you think about them?
Well, that's just it. Is the Saints, you know, they're good enough to beat anybody. You know, it's not going to happen on a consistent basis, but they're good enough to, you know, to throw a real wrench into this thing for somebody, be it Tampa or Atlanta. You know, and they could possibly, you know, upset somebody else that has got playoff aspirations as well. You know, typical NFC South, not a lot of attention is paid to it. Yet at the end of the day, you know, there's always a battle there. I mean, it's more intriguing most of the times than, you know, than the AFC East. Because that tends to be a one-team, you know, runaway situation in most cases, and kind of like that in a couple other divisions. But, you know, one thing you can say about the NFC South is it's always competitive. And if it's not two teams, it's three. So, you know, I don't think the Saints or Panthers this year are going to be a problem, or they're certainly not going to contend. But, again, they could still play a big role in who does win this division, and looking forward ahead to next year, kind of to what Roger had to say about Carolina and Bryce Young and the way he's turned things around. That's a team to watch going forward. They're going to be in a position to get a prime draft pick, premium pick in the first 2, 3, 4 rounds. And they have a chance to really improve themselves going forward if they just stick with the plan that they've got now. And turns out that the benching of Bryce Young was really a smart move because it's already paying dividends for him.
Well, I'd like to stay in the pros for a while because there's so many things, so many stories of the National Football League. If we have time, we'll come back to it. But, Roger, I don't really understand how Georgia could come into Memorial Stadium in Austin, Texas, and blow the Longhorns away on their home field. And now they're going to go to Atlanta in your backyard to play the championship game against the same Georgia Bulldogs. And it's a two-point game. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, first of all, it's the SEC. They've been playing at Mercedes-Benz, and before that it was at the Georgia Dome. I mean, I've been there, and that's just the way it is. But, Don, if you look at all these conferences, they all play sometimes in the backyard of one of the teams. I think the ACC is playing in Charlotte, okay?
Right.
So Clemson's right up the road from Charlotte. And you can just go, you know, the Big Ten's in Chicago. So that's just the way it is. It's strictly a dollars and cents deal. And they have the Fan Fest that begins on Friday, and it ends at 4 o'clock on Saturday, which is when kickoff is at the stadium. And, you know, I mean, well, when Alabama was there all the time, that's you make it to Tuscaloosa in about 2.5 hours, I think. I know, because the Birmingham's just under 2 hours. So, you know, it's centrally located for the original SEC, okay? The up until the last couple of years with Oklahoma, Texas, and all these other teams coming in. So that's just the way it is. It's marketing, and it's dollars and cents.
I'll buy all that, but that, my point being is this is a team that beat the Texas Longhorns in Austin, Texas at Memorial Stadium by what, like 40 points? And there is a two-point game going into the championship. I don't care where they play.
Don,
I mean, that's
yeah,
not,
but,
yeah.
But it's the game. It's the
Don,
game since then.
Yeah, Don. Let's not forget, Georgia had needed 8 overtimes to beat Georgia Tech last week. And, you know, let's not forget, Georgia Tech obviously told us well in advance of the season what Florida State was going to be this year. They've had a pretty good season, Georgia Tech. But still, you wouldn't expect Georgia to have to struggle with them, but they did. And I think that has a lot to do with that betting line being what it is. Hey, you know, the other thing is you can make the argument that you face a team a second time, you're going to learn a lot from it. And the second time around, you know, maybe the team that lost the first time around has the edge.
Well, I agree with that.
Roger
and I talked during
that.
Hold on a minute, Roger. You and I talked about this 8 overtime. I mean, I've never seen a game. Roger and I talked about it. I've never seen a game anything like this. I know there was one that was at 9 overtimes. But, I mean, I watched every minute of that game, and I mean, it was incredible. One of the most unusual, one of the best games you could ever see, in my view. Roger?
Well, okay. Here you're right. The all-time record is 9 overtimes. This one was 8. One of the, in my opinion, I watched it too, except for about 15 minutes when I was driving home. Okay, I listened to it on the radio. In my opinion, one of the great games to watch of all time. In my opinion, in my lifetime. And what you have here is just like Michigan, Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, this is a rivalry that goes back like a century. And there's so many Tech people that I am around every day and all these UGA. The coaches both had played against each other in college, Tech and UGA. And Kirby, if you saw the end of that game, those coaches embraced for an extended period. And there is no doubt in my mind they were both crying because that had to be one of the most draining games a coach has ever had to coach. And Kirby hit the nail on the head like you said, Don. He said, I've never, ever seen or been involved in a game like this in my life.
Well, it's hard to say anything else about it. I mean, you're right. It was absolutely, arguably, one of the most thrilling games, you know, in college football history. Plenty on the line, not for Georgia Tech, but, you know, if Georgia loses that game, you know, what does it say about their, what does it do to their playoff chances? They had to have that game, but Georgia Tech was playing like its life was on the line. So, It was just incredible. And you know what? As Roger said, this is what happens in rivalry week. And, you know, Florida State was close. Two teams that obviously don't have much to play for right now. But you throw out the, you know, and look at Michigan-Ohio State, as Roger said. I mean, just the games were incredible. Rivalry week always brings you some of the best football that you're going to see. Because, you know, it really doesn't matter what each team has done that particular year, how good they are, how bad they are. There's just something about rivalry week in college football that makes it absolutely special. And we got a lot of special this past weekend, that's for sure, starting with the Georgia-Georgia Tech game.
Well, you're right about that. At Florida also, they had a terrible start, but they won their last three. They signed 11 today, and that's got to be a giant move in the right direction. One other thing I'd like to talk about before we leave college football, and that is the Michigan-Ohio State game. Maybe my opinion is 100% wrong, but the talkers on TV and newspaper people talking about the coach at Ohio State who's won 10 games, who's gone to the national championship. That he should be fired because he's lost four games in a row to Michigan. I know this is, you know, this is the game. It's like Harvard and Yale used to be, you know. But, I mean, to fire a guy because he's lost four, Michigan beat them, so, you know, 13-10? I mean, I can't believe you could write that kind of stuff.
Hey, well, the same thing about Kirby when he lost games to Nick Saban at Alabama. You know, and he'd been in Alabama when Saban stabbed. I did want to say one other thing just to follow up about UGA. They were already in the SEC championship whether they won that game or not. So they may have still gone into the playoffs if they win the SEC championship. That's it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and we're going to have a chance to talk more about
Don,
that as we go. Go ahead.
Here's the thing, Don, and I'm with you on this. I don't understand. You know, the vitriol for, you know, for firing the coach at Ohio State, who's done a tremendous job with that program. I mean, they're
unbelievable.
In the playoff, and they are arguably one of the, you know, four or five best teams in the playoff this year. They're going to be there. They're going to make noise. They could win it all. And now they want the guy fired. Look, you know, okay, so you lost to Michigan. I mean, again, it's a rivalry game. You know, so many people are always so quick to say, fire this person, fire that person, for whatever it may be. It's just ridiculous. You know, we had a situation not too far away in Chicago last week where clearly, and this is granted to the NFL, but there's a coach there who just clearly didn't have his team ready for a very important situation. And maybe the quarterback wasn't ready for it, but that's the coach's job. And it's also the coach's job to call timeouts and know exactly how much time is left on the clock. I mean, And when you're reeling like the Bears are, you know, when you're just spinning your wheels as they've done for so many years, you know, you can make the argument, okay, this is a fireable offense. But losing to Michigan, you know, is not a fireable offense, in my opinion, in college football. And firing the coach, just it's not always the best thing. Sometimes, you know, firing players, you know, getting rid of players isn't the right thing. When you fire the coach, you're basically starting all over, and you are taking several steps backwards. You know, you're in a position right now where you can win a national championship this year. All will be forgiven if they do, and there's a good chance it could happen. So we'll see where it goes. But, you know, if you fire that coach after that game, your chances of getting through the playoffs are slim and none. You're going to have that problem. And going forward, you're going to have to start all over again. And let's not forget, we're in a new era in college football where the players are seeking opportunities to go play, and they'll go to other programs quickly if they don't see an opportunity where they are. And all the guys who are there committed to the coach that, you know, it's at Ohio State now could easily end up leaving. And so rebuilding, as we've learned here in Tampa, or not Tampa, but in Florida, with Florida State and Florida, rebuilding, guys, and with UCF, rebuilding. Look at Nebraska. Rebuilding is really difficult nowadays in college football. It is hardly ever seamless anymore. There are no quick fixes. You know, you're fortunate in Alabama, but clearly that team is not what it was under Nick Saban. So be careful what you ask for when you start firing coaches in college football these days. The landscape has changed, and it's going to be harder than ever now to rebuild if you fire coaches that are successful and you just get, you know, your backup over the fact that you lost your rivalry game this week to somebody. So be careful what you ask for there, folks.
To bear that out, all you have to do is look at Oklahoma. They just lost their quarterback. I mean, it doesn't take long. When as soon as the portal opens up, somebody's going. And Oklahoma lost their quarterback.
You know, and just a follow up about what both of you were saying, not only rebuilding, it's tough to stay up there because, you know, people, the players, especially quarterbacks, they're looking for an opportunity where they can show their talents, and it may not be with what's coming on board the following season.
Well, I want to get into another topic, but we're going to have to wait till next week because this first segment is over. Roy, thank you very, very much. I wanted to talk about that unbelievable head hit. You know, Shavir made, I mean, it's a three-game suspension for you almost kill a guy. I mean, what, are you kidding me or what? But we'll get to that next week or whatever happens. Thank you very much, Roy. It's always a pleasure.
Have a great week, Roy.
Jump all around. Doug Fernandez, one of the great columnists now in the Sarasota Herald, is going to join us right now. And I want to start off with Doug because he's an original Bostonian. But now it's Boston. It's the Dodgers are in the back seat, but Boston's supposedly in the front seat along with the Yankees. What do you think about Soto, Doug? What's your story on where's he going to go?
I'll tell you this. I share the opinion of legendary Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy, who's a cynic when it comes to these Red Sox owners who haven't spent money the last 5 years. Now, they said they were going to open up the pocketbook last year. They didn't do it. Now they say they're in the running for Soto. Shaughnessy said, I am not buying the cheese. I am not eating the cheese. In other words, he is not taking the bait. You know, the Red Sox could talk all they want about, you know, being involved in potential signings for this guy or that guy. Shut up. Put your money where your mouth is, right? I mean, don't talk about it. Do it. That's what Red Sox fans want to see. Now, apparently, Scott Boros, who represents Soto, like who else would, I mean, he issued a report, I guess a press conference or a press release, whatever it was, eliminating some teams. The Red Sox have not been eliminated, which is good news. So that shows me that they're putting their best checkbook forward here to really trying to go after this guy. Now, it's going to come down to, you know, apparently the Red Sox favor is a big hero of Soto has been David Ortiz growing up. And Ortiz now is like an unofficial advisor for the Red Sox. So he has really gone to bat with Soto about trying to sell him on the Red Sox, the history, how he would fit in at Fenway Park. I think he would just, his ability to go to the opposite field, he would just murder Fenway Park. But I think it may come down to with him, obviously money is going to talk. But I was thinking about this a couple of days ago, all right? He's talking about he's being linked to the Mets. I think that he would like to maybe stay, if all things being equal, he would like to stay in New York where he can go mano a mano as much as you can on a baseball field with Judge in the same city, right? Biggest city in America. You know, so you're playing every day in front of that New York media. They're going to be comparing your stats to Judge every day. And I think a guy like that might relish something like that. He could go to the Red Sox and take over that city, take over that town. But the Red Sox need more than him to get better. I mean, they really got to invest more money than just in him. Now they just signed Chapman. They got the hottest throwing left-hander in the game still. They signed him for 1 year. So that's going to help the back end of the bullpen. But they need starting pitching. If they sign this guy, they're going to have to get a couple of starters in place. I'm sure if he does sign with the Red Sox, they're going to assure him that, hey, you're not the only guy. We're going to go out and get a couple of guys rotation-wise to help you. But you put him in the lineup, you have Divas in the lineup, suddenly that lineup looks very attractive. And not only that, it becomes an attractive to other lesser free agents maybe that are looking around. At the Red Sox are opening up the checkbook again. They can do it. It's just a matter of them wanting to sign the big check.
Well,
so right now the Red Sox are in it. That's the only thing you can ask right now.
Well, they're talking about Devers moving over to first base too, and
the Red Sox have been linked to this trade for the third baseman for the Cardinals, and his name escapes me. He's been there several years and been a great, good player. Ariel, I forgot what his name, begins with an A. But if you look at his stats, he's gone down power. I looked at his stats. He's gone down power-wise the last two or three years in every category that matters. If you talk about home runs, RBIs, OPA, OPS, he's like 31 already. So some guys get older than others. I don't want to get a guy on the downside of his career and move Devers over to first, which is a good move because Devers really is not a Gold Glove third baseman, not even close yet. He's really regressed as a third baseman defensively. So move him to first base, but get somebody good to replace him. I don't know a guy who's gone down in numbers two or three years in a row is the kind of guy you want to get, but all eyes are on Soto right now. And I would think he's not going to wait that much longer. He's going to pull the trigger in the next few days, I would think.
Well, you're talking about Goldschmidt, but at the same time, you got the Mets, you got the Red Sox, you got the Blue Jays in the hunt. And Cohen, of course, has all the money. Whether or not Steinbrenner is going to open up the wallet to that degree, we have to wait and see. But it's an interesting story that's been going on for, since the last day of the regular season. I think one of the stories in the Post today, which I agree with 100%, if you go for whatever reason, laying in the woods back behind is always the Dodgers, and the league baseball can't afford to have another superstar go to the Dodgers. They're going to ruin the game if they do something like that. Roger, your thoughts?
Well, I wonder. Listen, obviously,
go ahead, Doug.
They don't have a
go
salary
ahead.
Cap. They don't have a salary cap in baseball, but they have a luxury tax. But apparently, when you're the Dodgers and you print money out there, you can basically say, the hell with the luxury tax. We'll pay it, and we'll go way, way over the limit for salaries. Yeah, listen, at some point, doesn't a superstar want to go to a team where there's not five other superstars, where maybe you can be the guy to lead a team back to greatness? I mean, if I'm a superstar and I see myself with the Red Sox, and knowing that I could bring that team back around to where it was 10, 20 years ago, that might be an enticing factor. I don't know what the makeup of this guy Soto is, right? You can talk about dollars and cents, but you don't know what's inside the guy really, really driving him in what direction. So I'm just glad the Red Sox are still in. If they don't get him, they better use this money that they have earmarked for him in other places because that team sucked last year. And what happened at the end of the year was indicative of a team that had overachieved all year, overachieved all season, and the last month of the season, they just ran out of gas. They just ran out of gas. They had given it all for 5 months, and they had nothing left. And with all due respect to guys like Nick Pavetta and Rob Reifsnyder, you're not going to win a championship with those kind of guys. You're not going to win a World Series with those guys, and they need to get other guys. And hopefully Gary Soto would be a start of it.
Roger?
Doug, I just want to say to follow up with that point that you were making about playing with a lot of superstars. That's exactly why Bryce Harper, when he left the Nationals and went to the Phillies, because he wanted to really get the Phillies back in prominence like they had been, 10, 12 years ago. When they, won the World Series and won the pennant. And he's done that. He really has. But then you have to surround yourself with a lot of other talent, and you got to get the pitching. And if you don't have the pitching, you're going to have a problem. And, I had seen one quote from Soto before the end of the year, and supposedly he said he knew exactly where he was going to go. But obviously, unless he's keeping it all close to the chest, that was just maybe a ploy in his case.
Well, I think, well, if you ask me, I don't think he expected the Red Sox to come out swinging like this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he expected the Red Sox to put out the kind of money that they have not put out in recent years, and they are putting out the kind of money that they have, but it's also matching the Dodgers, apparently the Dodgers and the Mets. It's in that ballpark, which is what you're going to be in. You're going to be above that $630, $40, $50 million threshold, and I guess the Red Sox are above it. They've sweetened the deal in the last 10 days to 2 weeks. So I got to believe it's going to be other things. Now it's not just money. It's other things that are going to entice him to go to a team. But you're right. Pitching is everything. A guy like that has to know that the team is going to be competitive. Soto does not want to go to a team like the Red Sox and hit 50 home runs and have it, you know, they have him go 500 or 10 games above 500 and they don't do anything. I don't think he wants to go to a situation like that. But I'm surprised he hasn't pulled the trigger yet. I'm surprised it's gone on this long. Usually guys of this magnitude, usually they're the first to lead off, right? They start everything off and they set the field a little bit. But this guy is so far above everybody else. I think he's in his own ballpark financially, you know? So, but at least there's people talking about baseball and at least baseball in Boston right now, which is good because the football team sucks. The hockey team is so-so. And the Celtics look like they're ready to defend the title right now. They are really good.
Well, at the same time, John Heyman has a full-page article today. It's bad for the game if the rich Dodgers get even richer. And I agree with that 100%. You can't have all these superstars. And in my view, Soto would be a perfect example. I mean, pitching, you just said it. Doug Rogers said the same thing. I'll go out and get three pitchers for the money that you're going to pay this crazy, you know, $700 million. I mean, you're going to win with pitching. He's not going to win the pennant for you by himself. He's not going to win. He did win it with the Yankees last year. He got the World Series with him because he had a lot of other help. But, I mean, you go to the Dodgers. I mean, he goes to the Dodgers, he's going to win automatically if that's what he's looking for.
You go to the Dodgers, listen. A baseball team maybe is not like a basketball team. You can't have five superstars, right? Michael Jordan didn't win a championship until he got a good surrounding cast around him. It's a little different. You can't – in baseball, it can be a little different. It's like a team game but a bunch of individual talent. So you can have five superstar baseball players, hitters, on the same team, and it will work. But you got to have the pitching. The problem is teams are hesitant to spend money on pitching from outside the organization. They bring this pitching in, and it either breaks down, gets injured, or it doesn't produce. Teams would rather homegrown their pitching where they know it. They've seen it from single A. They've nurtured it all the way up, and now it's ready for the major leagues. The problem is you don't see that a lot. The Red Sox haven't had one of those pitchers really since guys like John Lester, guys that they produced from their minor league system and then came into their majors. If you look at their roster this year, like a lot of teams, all the pitchers are brought in from somewhere else, right? They're not homegrown pitchers. I mean,
they're not winners.
Because that's too
right.
tough. That's tough to do.
Roger?
The Rays do a good job of it. They do a good job of it.
And Don and Frank, the Cardinals were always like that. You went by the Cardinals system from the time you were signed. You went into low A, high A, double A, triple A. It was the Cardinals system. And yet they have gone off, and I think gone off of their plan, because when they got Goldschmidt, and I think he – didn't he come from Milwaukee, I think? And but I knew he was not a long-time Cardinal. But
no.
I really think you've got to have that system where you develop them and bring them along. And I think Dave Dombrowski has done that with the Phillies because they do have some good young players coming up from the minors, including hopefully Andrew Painter's going to be okay. And what I disagree with is, If this guy has what everybody says he has and he's recovered from the surgery, I do not understand why you would not have him pitching from the very beginning in the major leagues, if he's that good. Because you're going to keep him in AAA, you could be down by 10 games, okay, by the time he came up if it was Memorial Day. You need to get off to a good start, just like the Phillies did last year, and then they tailed off at the end of the year, which I think had an effect on how they were in the playoffs.
One thing about Dombrowski, you know, he was with the Red Sox for quite a number of years, and he's
sure.
the one who gave Chris Sale a big extension of the contract, which he didn't have to do, and then he got hurt, and that was on his watch. So he left here kind of on bad terms. It's kind of nice to see him, you know, get back on his feet with another organization. I always thought he was a pretty good baseball man. He made a couple of bonehead decisions here in Boston, and then they brought in Chaim Bloom, who was a total disaster here. I guess he's got a job somewhere else. But they brought him in from the Rays, trying to do the Rays budget-conscious way of running an organization. And the money he did spend did not pan out at all. And they end up trading Sale, and he goes on to win the Cy Young. And the Red Sox guy they got, the guy the Red Sox got for him, Marquise Grissom, hit about 200 all year. So that is a trade on the level of Sparky Lyle for Danny Cater. Okay, that's what that kind of trade is.
And Ryan Sandberg. For that guy that the Phillies got from the Cubs, okay, the shortstop from the Cubs, a Hall of Famer for
Ivan DeJesus. No, Sparky Lyle went on to win a Cy Young with the Yankees. Danny Cater went on to hit 240 in 1 year for the Red Sox. Okay, they had lost George Scott. They had traded George Scott to the Brewers, so they didn't have a first baseman. They went out Sparky Lyle. They traded him. They got Danny Cater from the Yankees. Danny Cater was terrible. And then Cater was there for 1 year, and then they got rid of him. And the next year they had Yastrzemski back at first base, and they had Jimmy Rice in left field as a rookie. So Danny Cater was a disaster. That trade was a disaster.
Well, two things with Danny Cater. Hold on a minute. Two things with Danny Cater. One, he made that crossover catch at first base and broke his arm. That's the first thing. Anyway, the Danny Cater that got to the Red Sox and beyond was not the Danny Cater that started off his career in Major League Baseball. Number two, when you look at players that have moved around, look at Snell. Snell starts off with the Rays, wins the Cy Young Rookie of the Year. He's all over He's been to two other teams now. Now he's with the Dodgers. The Dodgers get the Japanese players. And Johnny,
Let me jump in here. This is so rich. It's unbelievable. Here we got a Yankees fan who bought everything through the last 50 years complaining about another team spending money on free agents. You have got to be kidding me.
He got you, Don.
You've got to be kidding me.
I'm not opposed to spending money on free agents, but how many can you have? I mean,
Here's the thing, Don. It takes two to tango. The Dodgers extend the money. The player is taking it. If it's equal money, why are they going to the Dodgers and not the Yankees or the Mets or the Phillies? If the money is equal, why are they going out to L.A.? I don't know. Is it that great of an organization?
The weather.
Athletes don't consider the weather. They're looking at dollar signs, and if dollar signs are equal, it has to be something else. The line
of
around.
We'll leave it right there. This segment is coming to an end. Thank you very much, Doug Fernandez, as always.
Wait. I'm not going anywhere, all right? I'm not going anywhere. You think I'm leaving? You're crazy.
Frank will
hey, Don,
cut the
wait,
line.
Don, wait. How are you feeling? You sound great.
I'm feeling good. I'm going to be down here in a few weeks. Don't worry.
We'll
be
breakfast
back with
or lunch
you,
or dinner, and I'll let you pay.
As you always do. That's one thing that's been consistent about you all your life. Everybody else pays.
Every time I see you, Don, listen, Don, every time I see you, I have a thirst and an appetite. okay?
Oh, that's great.
Take care. We got to go. We got to go because we got the Reliquus. Okay, take care, Doug. We got the Reliquus Bowl coming up, and that means that Mike Schulte is ready to talk. That maybe we might even have some teams that will be coming into Tampa for the bowl game. So we also want to talk about the change in time, when they're going to be played. But, Mike, first of all, welcome to the show once again. We got Doug Fernandez now back having a drink and having his dinner. But this has been a terrific, terrific week for college basketball, college football. Unbelievable that Georgia game the other day.
Yeah, that was pretty fun to watch, wasn't it? I mean, it was a little bit hairy, I guess, if you're fans of one of the teams. But boy, talk about edge of the seat. Viewing that was instant classic, a lot of fun to watch, and boy, just it sort of capped off the regular season, at least from the standpoint of all the different things, ups and downs throughout the season, and new teams emerging, into the top of the polls, and upsets, you know, every single week. As we say in our business, every week something happens you don't expect, and that's what makes it fun.
Mike, we've talked now the last few weeks, and what has happened so far, the picks that have been selected and where they're going, has it affected your bowls yet, or you still have to wait another week to see where you go?
Well, we don't know none of the bowls. Well, there's just a couple bowls. I mean, Hawaii Bowl and a couple that have special situations, But all the bowl games will be determined this Sunday after the conference championship games on Saturday, I guess Friday. It's coming down. It's down to the wire. I mean, most of the teams are done playing. Now we just have the conference championship games. And, what I'm sort of interested in seeing, as I just mentioned, it seems like every weekend we've had some upsets this year. I think I counted the other day there's at least nine teams that were ranked in the top 25 at the beginning of the year have ended up with either 500 or below 500 records. So it's been an interesting year in that regard. And what I'm sort of wanting to see is if the upset trend continues in the college conference championship games this weekend.
Roger?
Well, Don was asking about, because Georgia whipped up on Texas, his alma mater. And then he was talking about, well, now Georgia's going to be playing in their backyard. Well, and I told him, I said, if you look at every conference championship, they could be almost in the backyard of a participant in it. Okay, because, and it was in the World Congress or the Georgia Dome at the World Congress Center, and now it's at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. But it's all dollars and cents in marketing, isn't it, on all these sites?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's just how it's worked out, right? I mean, there was, not terribly long ago that Georgia was struggling a little bit, and Alabama was doing it. And you could say the same thing. Alabama's not terribly far from Atlanta. So, they pick these sites based on sort of central locations and large cities, within the footprint, or at least the original footprint of these conferences and all that. So, do you get a little bit of, effect that you got it close to home, maybe, but I don't think that's really that big of a factor in these games. Because you're typically not having teams that are traveling, all the way across country or whatever. It could be. I mean, certainly the Big Ten is because you got Oregon in there now. But, these sites were chosen, before you had conferences spread all the way across the country. So I'm just looking more from the standpoint of, the fact that they're, it's been very rare to have a weekend without some kind of major upset this fall, especially in the last month or so. And so I'm just wondering if there's is going to be any upsets, come this weekend. And, And frankly, there's probably only one that's really going to be that's really going to affect the teams that are in the playoff right now, and that's probably the ACC championship game. You know, if Clemson were to win that game, since they're right now outside of the top 12 in the rankings that came out last night, you know, that would potentially push out an Alabama or somebody out of the top 12 and possibly out of the playoffs. But they're both teams are going to be in.
Miami just stumped too, because they almost got almost eliminated themselves by losing over the weekend.
Miami's all right now. The way you got to look at the rankings, and again, these things can change, but they've made it pretty clear that the rankings are the rankings for teams that aren't playing this weekend, at least from the standpoint of the order that they're ranked. Okay.
Right.
So in other words, they're not going to take someone like, and I've told you this before, there's been times in past years where you had a team maybe ranked two spots ahead of another team, not so much, you know, in the 14 playoff part, but like in the lower part of the top 10, who didn't even play championship weekend. And then the next week they flip-flopped them, you know. So they've sort of come out and said that they're not going to do that kind of a thing. They're not going to, you know, reorder those teams that aren't, playing this weekend, you know, because there's not a reason to reorder them in their minds. But what I'm saying is that, like, if you look at the rankings right now, and I know we don't have time to go through all of them. If you look at the top 12, okay, and I actually don't have it right in front of me, but right now the number 12 is, I believe, Miami. If I'm not mistaken, is that right?
Yeah. I believe that's correct. They went from in to out.
So right
losing.
Now they wouldn't be in. They're not in the top. They're not in the playoff right now because below them are both teams that are playing in the Big 12 championship, and the Big 12 champion has a guaranteed spot. So when those two teams play, regardless of whether they move up the rankings or not, that team is in the 12th spot, which is Miami right now, isn't going to get in. So the question now is Alabama, because Alabama, I believe, is ranked 11th, and they could get knocked out if Clemson beats SMU, and because Clemson will automatically get a spot in the playoff, and that would potentially bump out another team, unless they were to drop out SMU out of the top 12, and I don't think they'll do that. I believe they're ranked like eighth. So that's sort of the linchpin right now, as far as, you know, that last spot. So right now it's the top 11 and the winner of the Big 12 championship game, unless Clemson beats SMU, which case then that put a second ACC team in and bump, in this case, Alabama out, and the SEC would only have three teams in the playoff.
Yeah, I thought they made a very clear distinction between why Miami would not be, because you look at the schedule and the games that they've lost, and the fact, as you said, that they're not playing this weekend pretty much eliminates them unless really something very unusual happens. Roger, you're up.
Yeah, they really are not in a position to move up and pass anybody.
Okay, so everybody can, that what we're talking about, let me give you the 12. Oregon, Texas, Penn State, Notre Dame, Georgia, Ohio State, Tennessee, SMU, Indiana, Boise State, Alabama, and Miami. And then it's Ole Miss, South Carolina, Arizona State. Now, the Miami lost to Georgia Tech when they were at the top of the mountain and undefeated. So that was one of their losses. The one that really surprises me, and maybe I'm way off base, Mike, is Notre Dame being number 4. I'm surprised at that pick. I'm probably way off, aren't I?
Well, I don't know that you're way off. I understand what you're saying, because you're talking about because of strength of schedule, correct?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's just, one of the things that you're gonna end up with in these kind of situations where you have a committee, picking. You know, when you have a team that's just, that wins, I think they they have one loss, or right?
One, yes, one
yeah.
loss. That's
yeah,
crazy
yeah,
loss. That's Northern,
right. so
well, Northern or Southern
11,
Illinois.
So look, yeah. So look at the top, that top 12, top 14 teams. Okay, there's, and again, I'm sorry, I can't see the actual rankings from me, but you have a few that are, you have one undefeated team. You have a few that have one loss, not that many.
Penn
and then
State,
you have
yeah.
some two-loss teams, and you and then you have, you know, Alabama's a three losses, and then a couple teams before behind them have three losses. So I think that's where you sort of look at it. You say, well, we're not going to leave, you know, 11-1 power four. I know they're not in a conference, but effectively they're a power four type of team. They're not going to leave an 11-1, just like Indiana is. They're not going to leave Indiana out of the playoff when they only got one loss, okay? And they played, you know, even though they didn't play what a lot, you know, one of the more difficult schedules, like some other teams, like Georgia, who played a really hard schedule. They played Clemson. They had to play at Texas, at Alabama, at Ole Miss, Tennessee. But they're not going to probably leave a team like that out when they're 11-1. When you got a bunch of two-loss teams in there, and maybe even a three-loss team, so I think that's sort of where they're coming from. Now, being ranked number four, yeah, I mean, you could, I wonder how that is, but I think it probably stems from the fact that they had a loss somewhat early in the year, and then they just kept winning, and other teams above them, you know, lost here and there, and so they just sort of, by virtue of that, they sort of climbed the ladder back up to number four. What's going to be interesting, though, is that, and something to remember, okay, and I know I've mentioned this before, as far as the playoff goes, okay, the teams are not seeded the way they are ranked, okay? So, mm-hmm. as an example, the top four seeded, the top four seeds in the playoff are going to be the winners of the four highest ranked, or I should say the four highest ranked winner conference champions. Okay, Notre Dame does not get a bye as far as how they're structured in this playoff. They don't get a chance to because they don't have a conference to be a conference champion in.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, so you have, so or let's just say Oregon wins the Big Ten, beats Penn State, okay? They'll have the number one seed, okay? But the number two seed, let's say Texas wins, they get the number two seed. Now, the number three seed then goes to the next highest conference champion, okay? Which isn't going to come, it's not going to be Notre Dame, it's not going to be, Ohio State or Indiana or whatever, or Tennessee, it's going to be, or Georgia, it's going to be, you know, one of the other ones. It could be Boise State, or it could be SMU, for instance. So we'll get the number three seed, the other one will get the number four seed. Now you go back up and look at teams that haven't already been seeded, and now the highest ranked team at that point gets the number five seed. Well, you know, like I said, who knows who that's going to be? It could be Notre Dame or whatever. But my point in all of it is that when the final rankings come out, you know, Notre Dame might be ranked number four, for instance, but they may be the sixth seed or the seventh seed in the playoffs.
Yeah,
right.
And so the other thing is that if there's a conference champion who is ranked outside of the top 12,
Michael, just to say, we got some background noise. There's dogs barking and something's going on back there. Go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
Well, that's probably Roger barking. So when we,
I don't have a dog.
That's what I mean. But
hey, you're
like
getting better, Mike. You're getting better.
The winner of the Big 12 championship right now, they're ranked, I think, like, I don't know, 13 or 14 and 15 or something like that. So if they don't move up in the top 12, they get the 12th seed because they're ranked, they'd be ranked outside of the top 12, so they automatically get the 12th seed. So
okay, let's hold it right there. Let's hold it right there. Let me ask you just two quick questions. Number one, this time next week when you're on, will you have your teams known by then?
Yes, yes. So all the bowl games will determine their teams this Sunday.
Okay.
Okay. So,
so
all
you'll,
the teams
you'll
be
able to give us
Sunday
some,
afternoon.
Okay, so you'll give us that information and also the time change. I always want you to get into the time change because a lot of people don't know.
Yeah, thanks. So the ReliQuest Bowl will be on New Year's Eve day this year, kicking off at noon Eastern time. So December 31st at noon will be the only game on for a few hours. We will have a terrific matchup, and we're looking forward to a great matchup that we'll be able to get and invite and announce on Sunday, this coming Sunday. But we'll be playing on December 31st at noon on ESPN, and we're very, very excited about it. And, of course, we have all the fun events leading up to the game during the week beforehand, and we're just looking forward to having another great experience for people in the Tampa Bay area and the fans who come in from all over the country.
All right, so next Wednesday night we'll go over all that. We'll go over ticket prices. Trevor's all ready to go.
Well,
Roger, we got to be out of this segment.
Tickets are available at Ticketmaster, so they're available right now at Ticketmaster.
Okay, Mike, thank you very, very much. We'll do it all next week. Give everybody all the latest news of what's going to be happening. Take care.
All right, take care, guys. All right, stay out of trouble.
Well, we're going to stay on the football front again, but this time we're going to go back to the pros again. Trevor Busso is all set to go. And, Trevor, you got a lot of National Football League news and, more importantly, a lot of surprises of teams that are winning that we expected to win.
Yeah, thank you guys again for having me on. It's greatly appreciated. You're definitely not wrong there. A lot of, I think, continuous upsets and more disappointments than not to this point in my opinion. 2 weeks ago, I touched up on the 49ers. I still think that Shanahan's a good coach. Others have their own opinions, teach their own, obviously, in that regard. But I think their season, after what I said a few weeks back, still trusting in them. The division is still up for grabs, the Rams winning, the Cardinals losing this past weekend, but Christian McCaffrey going down with a PCL injury is, out for the year. And then their backup, Jordan Mason, also out for the year on IR. So I think the Niners are effectively, their season is done. They could, sneak in the playoffs somehow, but just based on what we've seen, I just think it's going to be a stagnant year, which we're definitely not used to from this team because they've been in the playoffs and have made deep runs in the playoffs. Like the past 5 years, they've been a consistent contender in the NFC. So the Niners are definitely my biggest, a huge disappointment. And it really just came down to injury. I mean, Fred Warner as well has been playing like 10 weeks on a broken ankle. I didn't even know that until this weekend. That's insane. So they're playing with duct tape and glue with that roster. So they have a lot to work on in this offseason for sure. But after this weekend, that was kind of my biggest takeaway from like disappointments in terms of that aspect.
Roger?
Trevor, a couple things. One about the 49ers and Christian McCaffrey. I felt when he had the first injury, he missed, 6-7 games, and then he came back, and I didn't see him looking like himself, and then he goes down and he's out for the year. And then I start thinking about running backs. There's very few Derrick Henrys that at that age are still producing like they are, and he's just a tremendous guy, a tremendous player. But I just wonder now if Christian McCaffrey's running back career is over with. And I think when you start getting in 1 year two major injuries, I think you have to start thinking about that. That's number one. I also wanted to ask you about what you think about the Falcons Minnesota game coming up, with Kirk getting to play against his old team, and the Falcons really in a free fall. What's your opinion about those two things, 2 points?
Great notation there about the running back shelf value. Chris McCaffrey did post on his Instagram this week that, you know, kind of an eerie message that, he might retire. And this might be his last season. And he's been in the league for a long time now, playing at an incredibly high level. But with the volume and the tenacity and the ferociousness that he played with for all these years in Carolina and then especially in San Francisco, there probably is not much tread left on the tires, especially like you said, 2 major injuries in 1 year. You know, it doesn't look good. They might rehab it, try and, see what they can do at camp and in the off season. But, you're right. There's a very minimal chance or percentage chance that we'll see, the vintage Christian McCaffrey, in my personal opinion, just based on the amount of sheer stress put on the running back position, especially in that offense. But getting into the matchup between the Falcons and the Vikings game, good revenge matchup, obviously. That's, good for the storylines. But Kirk Cousins in the last 3 games, I don't think he has a touchdown pass. I think he has, 7 interceptions, 700-something yards. He has not looked good the past couple weeks. And this is a team where, a month ago we were all talking about, they're going to walk away with this division just based on the landscape. And, now it's kind of not the case anymore. The Bucs are still in it. The Panthers have turned it around. It's going to be interesting, but I got to go with the Vikings in this game. I just think they have a better team. And obviously I think they have a better coach in Kevin O'Connell. You could argue, it's not even an argument in my opinion, but Sam Darnold is definitely playing better football and has had a better season than Kirk Cousins, at the quarterback position. So when you have one team with a better coach and quarterback, I'm going to favor that in that matchup. But, we've seen Kirk come out after a rough game. He threw 4 picks this past weekend. We've seen him come out after that type of performance and play lights out. So we could see this team perform to its level that we know it can perform to. They have the talent. I like Raheem Morris. I just think that they're way too bipolar with their performances. They're very up and down week by week, like a roller coaster ride. But once you can get that stabilization in that locker room and on the field, I think this team is definitely going to be dangerous. They have the skill position guys. They have the defense to make plays. They have one of the best safety tandems in the league, in my opinion. So, there shouldn't be a reason they fumble this season, but they sure as heck might if Kirk Cousins doesn't start playing better football.
Trevor, I want to go to Baltimore because we saw them play the Eagles over the weekend, and the Eagles really took them to school. From Jackson's standpoint, in my view, looked like it was a playoff game. It looked like he was playing one of the playoff games. He was so confused by the defense that the Eagles were throwing at them. But more importantly, they've lost a lot of games now. And Harbaugh's, they've got this week off, but Harbaugh is in a position now where, they could totally miss the playoffs with a two-time MVP who just doesn't play well when he goes up against a team that has the kind of defense that the Eagles have or the kind of defense that he's seen in the last couple of playoff years. Your opinion?
No, I definitely agree with your statement that looked like a playoff matchup. It looked like, some of the upper echelon teams playing against each other. And, clearly the Eagles have the better defense, and it matched up very well against their offense and the Ravens. What I think it really comes down to is you can really minimize Lamar Jackson's game if you can stop the run. And that's exactly what the Eagles defense did. They did not let Derrick Henry go insane like he normally does. In fact, it was their running back, Saquon Barkley, who looks like the MVP right now, making the plays and continuously, driving the offense downfield and pretty much the catalyst of this offense, in my personal opinion. We haven't seen the Eagles play the way they've been playing, years prior. This is Saquon. His performances as of late have been historic. They've been insane. Combine that with A.J. Brown and Jalen Hurts playing smart and safe football. Also, couple that with his rushing ability. They have an insanely, you know, deadly offense. And going into the game, the Ravens' back end, their defensive backs and pass coverage, really probably bottom 12 in the league, bottom 15. So it's not really like they have this great pass defense. So they got exploited there for sure in those big play moments. But in my opinion, it really just came down to, like you said, the Eagles' defense kind of blindsiding the Ravens' offense. And like you said, the Ravens have dropped some games like this year. I think they're at 5 losses now. So there's a likely chance if they don't get back on a, you know, on some kind of stretch of winning, they either get in barely in the wild card or they miss the playoffs entirely.
Well, before I throw it to Roger, Jackson, the only real play he made in the game was in the last 30 seconds when he made that long run. Well, the game didn't count. I mean, when, you know, the passes that he threw in the last minute and 30 seconds and the run that he made to set up the score were really meaningless because the game was over. Roger?
Well, excuse me, that's exactly right, Don. I mean, that game was over, and excuse me, that was going to be, what, the first time, I think, this season that they would not have scored in the second half until they scored that TD. But,
right.
You know, it just goes to show you that you can have all kinds of stats in a game, but stats don't win the game. The stat that does win the game is the final score. And, Trevor, I agree with you, and Don, too, because Jackson looked confused. And he's looked that way in playoff games, as both of you said. And I just wonder whether that is just a sign, you know, maybe the teams have caught up to him and they know how to contain him. And that's why they do have 5 losses this year, because they are a good team, but I don't think the defense is anywhere near comparable to the Eagles or the top defenses in the league.
It's actually weird. Lamar Jackson in his NFL career has only lost 2 times to NFC teams. One of them was led by Jalen Hurts, as we just saw. And then the second time, but this was, I think, 2 or maybe even a year ago, was to Daniel Jones with the New York Football Giants. So I think that, you know, this is telling for the Eagles that they have a special team. They have a lot of young players on defense. I really like Cooper DeJean, Blankenship back there, as well as Quinyon Mitchell. I mean, they have really good playmakers, especially their front 4. And like you guys said, the pressure, it got to Lamar Jackson. He wasn't on his A game like he normally, you know, has shown in these types of games this year. But, you know, his track record in big moments definitely is not the best for a 2-time MVP. But it's, you know, it's very, like I said, it's telling for the Eagles. They shut down an offense that has 2 potential MVPs on it, with Lamar Jackson, with Derrick Henry, both guys that are, I think, both in the top 5 and, you know, favored odds to win MVP. They shut down this offense, and they also, you know, broke a streak of Lamar Jackson kind of just owning an NFC opponents in regular season time, which, you know, that's coaching as well. And Vic Fangio and Kellen Moore, those guys definitely had a solid game plan and came in and were ready to play. You know, nothing else really to put it. You guys said it. The game was over far before the fourth quarter and before the actual game was over. It was like, what, 30-16? So a lot of those big plays, like we were just talking about, were in garbage time, didn't really matter. But, yeah, no, the Eagles are definitely they catapulted themselves into that Super Bowl contender conversation after that win over Baltimore, for sure.
Roger, you were talking about a team that was coming on and to look out for them as the season continues to unfold, and maybe you'd get Trevor's opinion of your observations of the team in the
Carolina.
Yeah, Carolina.
Yeah, Carolina Panthers. Just let me say one thing. Trevor, you know, probably too young. Don and Frank, you'll remember this. And Andy Reid was a new coach. They had Troy Vincent and Bobby Taylor, you know, at the corners. And what did they do? They went out and got Lito Shepherd and Sheldon Brown. And here they were. Then they became a tremendous twosome. And that's exactly what the Eagles did, that Howie Roseman did, by drafting those two young corners that have just, as rookies, been phenomenal, really. But my the point Don was making, I feel, Trevor, that the Panthers are on the right track, and they are going to be a team in the NFC South. They're young. The quarterback, Bryce Young, is now stabilized. We talked about him getting benched by the coach, and he's really come back. Because I think Andy Dalton got he was out for the season. He was the backup, and he went in there. But what's your opinion of the future of the Carolina Panthers?
Yeah, first, I completely agree with what you said about drafting the two corners, and that's a huge statement for the organization. And I honestly, one would argue, Quinyon Mitchell might be the best corner in football right now. If you look at the numbers, if you look at the matchups he's had, it's either between him or Christian Gonzalez in New England. But yeah, Quinyon Mitchell has been outstanding so far this year. But getting into the Panthers, a little bit of an early prediction, but next year I think they will be in the playoffs. Maybe just a little wild card appearance, but I think that that's a likely possibility. I'm not going to sit here and say I like Dave Canales after, the two, stops in Seattle, then Tampa, then getting that six-year head coaching contract. I don't really think it justified it. But as of lately, the past three or four games, it's been Bryce Young's best month of football in his career, in the NFL, obviously. But, he's definitely turned things around after coming back in from the benching. The team around them seems to be playing a lot better as well. Adam Thielen this past weekend was looking like his old self. I mean, and they don't have a good team. You know, they don't have this great roster. They don't have a good defense by any means. But, it does show they seem to have some of the coaching elements in place. They have Bryce Young, build around him. They have good running backs in Chuba Hubbard. Unfortunately, him losing that fumble in overtime sucked, but throughout the season, he's been really good for the team. They need to get wide receivers. They definitely need to build the offensive line in the draft. But you're right, though. The Panthers, they're a young team. They got young coaches. They're really trying to turn around the culture in this franchise and trying to get it back to what it was and being a consistent organization rather than it being in the poverty status. But they got a lot of work to do, but we're definitely seeing growth. And that's what you really want to see out of a young quarterback trying to take helm of a, like you said, a young team in a kind of a turnaround mode for this Carolina Panthers organization.
Trevor, before we jump out of this segment real quickly, your thoughts on Knicks, how he is improving, how he is growing.
Man, we talked about Jaden Daniels earlier this year and how I think he definitely should have been the Offensive Rookie of the Year. But as it's been going on at this current juncture, I do believe Bo Nix is the Offensive Rookie of the Year with what he's been doing with the Denver Broncos. Him and Jaden Daniels have been exceptional, but Bo Nix, he's been pushing the ball downfield, playing it safe, but also, taking those calculated risks. But him and Sean Payton, combined with that incredibly gritty defense in Denver, that is a very, very dangerous team who, in my opinion, I believe that they will get a win against the Chiefs in their second matchup against them this year. And if they play in the playoffs, just an early prediction, I believe the Broncos can beat the Chiefs in the playoffs. I think this is a team that's built for those one-and-done situations, and I think that they have the players, the veterancy, and the youth to be able to kind of battle their way through the wild card and maybe make some kind of divisional push in the postseason this year. But I really like Bo Nix. I think he's going to be a really good quarterback going in the future.
Trevor, as always, thank you very much. We'll kick it all again next week and go right from one thing to another, and then we're going to go from football to soccer. Our soccer expert is on the line right now, and the one thing we want to talk about when we talk about soccer, Mike Simczak joins us, of course, each and every week. Before I talk about some of the things that happened of real interest in soccer this week, 4 o'clock, MLS championship game is going to be played, and so I'd like you to start with that one, even though that's in the future. It's going to be New York against the Galaxy, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Some of your observations on that one.
I think MLS got really lucky after Lionel Messi and Inter Miami and their superstar team went down in the first round of the playoffs, its first hurdle, they somehow snuck into getting their two biggest markets and two of their most famous clubs into the MLS Cup. And
right.
for nothing, I mean, LA Galaxy have been one of the more exciting teams this season. They've scored a lot of goals. They've got 69 for the season, which is only two behind Columbus and nine behind Inter Miami. So they're the third leading scoring team in the league. They've also given up quite a few. So normally you would expect to see goals in this game. They've got some brand name players in Marco Reus. They've got some exciting young talent in Gabriel Peck and Joseph Pansel. So LA Galaxy is, it's one of the winningest team in MLS. They've been to the MLS Cup Finals 10 times. This is the first time since 2014. 2 years ago, their supporters basically launched a coup to get the sporting director and the president of the club ousted. They staged a walkout. They stopped showing up for games, and attendance fell off a cliff. They got the changes that they wanted in their back. On the flip side, New York has kind of just snuck in. They finished. They only had 11 wins on the season. They only picked up one win in their last nine MLS regular season games. They didn't win a single game in the Conference Cup. They were pretty much left for dead, and they made a tactical switch to be more defensive and focus on scoring from free kicks and corners in the playoffs, and it's worked. They've only given up two goals in the playoffs. So you got your two biggest brand names in the playoffs. You've got and you've got a case of the immovable object in the Red Bulls defense versus the irresistible force. At least we think it would be in the LA Galaxy offense.
Roger, before I go to you, North Carolina is down by 9 to Alabama right now at half. Roger, you're up.
Well, talking about basketball, I'm watching Connecticut and Baylor, 15th rank against Connecticut, 25th rank. And Connecticut's up with 7:23 left in the second half, 61-54. My question is, how come UConn is ranked 25th in the country as the returning national champion? National champion, doesn't make any sense.
They lost three in a row. They were in Hawaii. They lost three in a row.
3 in a week.
Yeah, three in a row.
That answers the question. But anyway, getting back to soccer, Mike. What? How do you look at this match that Don described and you talked about? Is this going to be a high scoring affair? Because the Galaxy does. Score relatively a lot of goals, relatively speaking. That's number one. The site, do you think they'll pack the place? And what's the TV situation look like?
Okay, I'll answer the last one first. The game is available for free on Apple TV Plus, and it'll be available on Fox Deportes, and the Fox streaming services. So they are going to have the game on terrestrial TVs for those who want to see it. The venue is going to be a sellout. It's being played in Dignity Health Park, which is the home field of the LA Galaxy. So I expect that the home field advantage will be very much in Galaxy's favor. As for the matchup, I actually don't think that it's going to be a high-scoring game. The way that New York has gone about this, they're very, very, very comfortable defending. And I don't know that LA Galaxy is going to be able to find the space in transition to push the ball at the tempo that they would like to. On top of that, their best player and probably a candidate for MLS MVP, Ricky Puig, went down with a torn ACL in the second half of the game. He actually played for a half an hour with a torn ACL on his left knee and provided the assist for the winning goal. When you talk about key players, I said that LA Galaxy has scored 69 goals in 34 games. Ricky Pugh scored or assisted on 37 of them. So that is a massive piece to take out of your lineup for a key game. Normally, I would say with a fully healthy roster, I think LA would get the better of them, and they might be able to put up a crooked number. Looking at what I'm seeing, the fact that they are missing such a key piece, I still think LA Galaxy gets it done at home, but I think this might just be a one-goal game.
Well, Mike, let's switch gears here. There's so many things to talk to you about this week, but not the least of which is the USWNC. Coach Hayes coming over from England to the United States, and I don't know how many people saw the game. I can't remember whether I saw it on Saturday or Sunday. I think it was on Sunday. But so I got a two-point question. Number one, your thoughts on the young lady coming from the English team over here, even though she's got quite a reception during that exhibition game. And also, number two, what do you think of the game?
Emma Hayes, who's the coach of the U.S. Women's National Team, was probably the best person that we could get to coach the women's team. You know, she was the coach. She won a Olympic gold medal, and she'd only had the team for a week when she took over. Led them to the Olympic gold medal. She has not, that I know of, lost a match yet as head coach of the U.S. Women's National Team. As for the game over in England, it was a friendly. It was the last game of the calendar year for the U.S. Women's National Team. Alyssa Mayer, who has been just a stalwart in goal since 2018, this was her final game for the U.S. Women. It ended up as a nil-nil draw. That said, England are a really, really good team. Playing them in Wembley was always going to be tough. And the U.S. women did not bring our front three, Marilee Swanson, Sophie Smith, Trinity Rodman to the game. They were all rested after the NWSL playoffs for various reasons. So that firepower, which is what I think is one of the most important parts of what makes that team so successful, missing all three of them, it was always going to be a tough ask to get that win. So they'll be off for a couple of months before they gear up for the She Believes Cup, which is normally played in y'all's neck of the woods. That'll be the first real test of the 2025 season. You know, we're entering into that sort of dead period for women's soccer, coming out of the Olympics and then trying to gear up. We got about 2 years before the next Women's World Cup and the 2028 Olympic Games. So we're starting a new cycle. You know, this will be where we start to see some new faces. We've got to get a new goal, break in a new goalkeeper. We're going to have to get some new who's going to play in central defense. Not that Naomi Girma is nailed on. She's going to be the captain, but they're going to have to find somebody to partner her because Becky Sauerbrunn's gotten a little bit old in the tooth. They're going to need some more reinforcements in midfield and on the wings. So we're going to start to see Emma Hayes really put her mark on the team as she brings new ladies in and starts to identify who her top, say, 30 are on that roster.
Mike, I thought you made a very fair evaluation. Two observations I had, not knowing anywhere near as much about soccer as you do. Number one, the way she was received during the game after switching and being a big part of what happened in soccer and then switching over to the United States team, the reaction of the fans, I thought that was quite interesting, the way that they handled that. And number two, I was very disappointed in the way it was written up. I think your observation was much clearer, the fact that because there was no really scoring offense, a little bit in the first half, but not very much. And, I mean, it was really just an exhibition of kicking the football, kicking the ball around. I was a little disappointed that there wasn't really any major competition in this game.
The English women are kind of in mid-season right now. The U.S. women are at the very, very tail end. This is it for them until they restart. It was an exhibition game. They played it like an exhibition game. You've got one group who's probably trying – they want to play each other. You know, this is a big test for both of them. England has designs on upsetting the United States, and they have a really doggone good coach too. So I think that you saw two teams that were playing it a little bit close to the vest. It was a friendly. They weren't trying to show too much to each other. But I suspect in a competitive World Cup type match or Olympic match that you'd see a much, much different game, especially when both of these teams are at full strength.
Right. I agree with you. Roger?
You know, Mike, before we let you get away, the I wanted to get your opinion on the Commanders and exactly, you know, they've lost a few games and still the fan support strong and also the media and sports talk feel the Commanders are going to be okay to make it into the playoffs.
You know, everybody's still cautiously optimistic. If you had told any of these fans at the beginning of the season that this was an 8-win team, I think that anybody would have walked off and took it, considering where they were last year, to more than double their win total with a rookie quarterback, a bunch of players who are basically signed on short-term deals with prove-it type deals, a new head coach, a new GM. They turned over pretty much the entire roster. There is not a single first-round pick from Ron Rivera's tenure remaining on that team. They released the last one, Emmanuel Forbes, last week. So there is not a single first-round draft pick of Ron Rivera's on this team. When you come in and you're trying to build a team, you count on those premium draft picks to be contributors, and they don't have that. The Dallas loss hurt. Everybody was very upset. That was a very winnable game. They thought that they could get it. It didn't work out like that. Going and thumping the Titans like they did last week has kind of alleviated some of that pain, but I still think that people are still optimistic. There's still this kind of underlying anxiety amongst the fans and the media that of a fan base that has just been broken down over the course of the last 25 years. You know, they just feel as though we can't have nice things. So they're waiting for the wheels to fall off. And there's this building anxiety and angst that at some point it's just all going to come undone. There's nothing that would suggest that's what's going to happen. I still think that this is a playoff team. This is a team that can find easily another two wins in its remaining games to get to 10 wins, which should be good enough to get them in the playoffs. And where they go from there, look, they're way ahead of – they're at least the easiest season ahead of schedule based on where I thought they would be. Jaden Daniels may have cooled off a little bit from his start. I heard Trevor talking about he would give the Rookie of the Year to Bo Nix now, and I can't argue with him too much. Bo Nix has been playing way better lately than Jaden Daniels has, but Jaden Daniels has proven that he is the right guy for this job and that they can be successful, and this is a team that you need to pay attention to in the NFC East for the foreseeable future.
Mike, I want to switch gears on you again. I always jump in with different things, but your hockey club, all of a sudden, making a little bit of noise. I mean, you know, the Devils are up on top right now, but they're certainly not dominating anything. And Washington, we've talked about it a number of times with, you know, how they're going to do it. Last year, we were fighting it out about whether they were going to make the playoffs or whether they weren't. How many goals were going to be scored? Was there going to be a new gold champion in the National Hockey League, which still may come up this year? Your observations of Washington.
This is a team right now that leads the NHL in scoring, and they haven't had Alexander Ovechkin for like 2 weeks because he broke a leg. He just got back on the ice skating. He's not taking part in practices. He was skating around in sweats earlier this week on Monday. But they've been without Alex Ovechkin, and we thought the wheels might come off when he went down, but they
right.
actually scored more. It's a team that just it doesn't have stars. It just has a lot of solid players who work as a team and a really, 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 really good head coach. They're a well-coached team. And they – who knows? It is a long season. I've said to you, gentlemen, many times, it's hard to make predictions on the future of the NHL until after Valentine's Day and the Super Bowl. That's when you can really start paying attention and get a feel for who's going to do what. But, you know, it's always nice when you get off to a really, really good start, and that's what they've done. And, you know, they've taken guys like Pierre-Luc Dubois, who was basically a cast-off. He hasn't been lighting the net up for the Caps, but he's been a good locker room guy. You know, they're getting contributions from Connor McMichael. It's just a team that seems to have what it needs right now, and they're finding success.
Roger?
Hey, Mike, let me say one thing about the Caps. You may have seen it. I was watching ABC 7 DC tonight one of the news. And they did it today. They had a absolutely great time on the ice with not handicapped, but challenged children. And to see their smiles and trying to get the puck in the net and the players talking to them. And I understand this is an annual affair. They need to be given a lot of credit. That what I saw was really just an outstanding operation and a wonderful piece that they did today, a wonderful event. I don't know whether you saw it or you were aware of it or not.
I didn't see it. I was aware of it. I know that this is about the time of year where they start to do stuff like that. And kudos to the Capitals organization. They've always been a really positive community partner. They are very active in the community, and it shows, you know, going back to when they won the Stanley Cup, this was a team that was definitely out celebrating with the fans. It was nothing to see Alexander Ovechkin and Backstrom with the Stanley Cup, drinking out of the Stanley Cup in the middle of a fountain in Georgetown. Like, those things, you're just turned up everywhere. So they're definitely part of the DC community, and they like it, and the community loves them for it.
Yeah,
my grandstand question for you tonight is: the big meeting took place about taking over Robert F. Kennedy Stadium, and what's going to happen with the transition? Are they going to be able to get that land and get it done? And the owners of the Redskins, or not the Redskins, the Commanders. And everybody now, it looks like they're going to try to make some progress.
They're trying to make some progress, but this is really – I'm happy that you asked about it, because there's this really, really, really weird deal in there where, I kid you not, the Maryland is asking for fighter jets from the D.C. National Guard as part of this deal.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, talk about a trade. I've never heard of that one before.
You cannot make this up.
No, you can't.
They want some planes from the D.C. Air National Guard as part of this transfer. I don't have a clue. I cannot. I read it. I still do not understand it. I'm not understanding how this is all going to work, but something about the relocation of the Commanders and part within the transfer. Maryland wants compensation for losing that and not getting the team and stuff, whatever. And one of the ways they want it is in the form of, I think, F-16s or F-22s. They want fighter jets.
Well,
so,
we'll
hey,
follow. We'll follow this up.
$100 million worth of plane.
We'll follow this up as we go along. Doug Hamilton is all set to go.
Have a great
Mike,
week,
thank
Mike.
You very much. We covered a number of topics, and we got right on top of things.
Yeah.
Okay, take care. Have a good night.
You too, gentlemen.
Doug Hamilton. Hamilton can't be too happy tonight after that Eagle performance on Monday night against the Ravens. Doug, they just couldn't get on track against the defense that the Eagles threw up against them.
I don't know. I mean, I think Baltimore looked pretty good for about three quarters. You know, I think I was more scared of A.J. Brown having a bigger night than Saquon Barkley. And so they contained him for a majority of the game, and then the Eagles kind of got themselves going in the fourth quarter. And, I mean, a late touchdown that was, you know, a garbage touchdown. But, I mean, it's very frustrating, I think. I'm listening to a lot of, you know, local radio here in sports talk, and you wouldn't believe the level of discord amongst, you know, the Ravens fans and some of the things that they're saying about, you know, just in general, like the coaching staff and some of the players, and obviously the largest finger you can point is directly at Justin Tucker for having, you know, by all accounts, I mean, he's a 90% field goal kicker for his lifetime, then he's, I think it's 70%.
Possibly.
Well, it's hard to get in as a special teamer, but, you know, by and large, you could say that he has stood the test of time for majority of, what, 12 years, I think, he's been in the league, and made a lot of really huge kicks, you know, 66-yarder against Detroit. I mean, just a storybook career. He's 35 years old, but this year he's been lackluster and missing, you know, a number of kicks that could have, because, I mean, when you really look at how that game ended, the Ravens were forced to go on a 4th-and-8 that they didn't get, that they, you know, wound up Eagles converting into a touchdown. And, you know, if Tucker makes an extra point in a field goal or whatever, all three of those kicks, they punt the football and we might have a different outcome. So it's hard to watch and say it was so-and-so's fault because, you know, could Lamar have run the ball a little bit more? Could, you know, he made a couple really easy throws that he missed. You know, I think it's encouraging that the Ravens defense in the last 3 weeks has looked a lot better than it has over the course of the season, but there's still too many things that work against them, you know, from just untimely penalties to, you know, obviously missed kicks to missed throws, missed catches, missed receivers. I mean, there's a lot of little things and bigger things that need to get cleaned up if, you know, if they're going to continue. I mean, they're still, what, a game, two games up on the Colts, I think, for that last playoff spot. I mean, you know, I think it's – you're going to see a huge game in Pittsburgh versus Cleveland. If Pittsburgh wins that game, then the following week, you know, the Ravens play Pittsburgh, and they could wrap up the division or the division at that point with a win. So, you know, we're getting down to the nitty-gritty here, and we want to make sure that as a Ravens fan that we find a way to get into the playoffs, and then we can, you know, worry about whatever happens then.
Well, I'll buy all that. The only thing is that, as I said earlier, we did a little segment on the National Football League earlier in the show today, tonight, and my thought was that we looked at the same Lamar Jackson that we see in the playoff games. He was confused. I mean, he just didn't have the fluidity of the play calling and reaction. The defense of the Philadelphia Eagles took him all out of his – he had no concentration of what he was going to do.
Well, he said in a I guess it was post-conference that he said something about his mom cussing him out because he didn't run the football enough. But if you watch that game – it's almost like, and I said this, I can't remember if I said this to my wife or who I said this to, but like the old Lamar, right? Like when he was just, you know, indoctrinated into the league.
Right.
He would look at his first read, and that's where the play was designed to go. And if it wasn't open, he'd pull the ball down and he'd run it. Now, he looks at his first read, and then he scrambles around and he doesn't run the football, but he's trying to make something happen because he wants to throw it. And he made some really bad throws and has. You know, I think he needs to be a little bit more decisive with the football. And as he said, he didn't run the football because he was trying to go through his progressions. But damn, if you watch that football game, I think it was the first drive that the Ravens had the football. Mark Andrews was wide open down the right-hand side with not a soul near him. And I feel like there's a lot of cases in the games that I watch that you have wide receivers that are standing wide open and he doesn't see them. And he tries to stick the ball into the tiniest of window to fling it in there. And it's the same sword you live by is the same sword you die by. But the pass that was caught at the end of the game, I think, by likely for the touchdown, could have easily been intercepted. And you, that's what you see. You know, you see these plays that could go either way. And it's frustrating because, you know, watching the Ravens, they're incredibly talented, I think, on both sides of the football. But, you know, at 8-5, you know, hell, they could easily be – I mean, in every game that the Ravens have lost, Justin Tucker has missed at least one field goal, if not more. And I think there's been a lot of, you know, field position issues and
right.
concepts that tie into that. And, I'm not placing the blame on him, but it's very noticeable that we're lacking points, you know, because if you're John Harbaugh and it's 4th-and-4 and you have a 48-yard field goal, what are you going to do? You know what I mean? At this point. So
they repeatedly showed that particular play where he was wide open 2 or 3 times and were pointing out the fact that, hey, what's the matter? The guy, there's nobody within 15 yards of him, and they don't throw him the ball. But, Roger, you're up.
No, I saw that too. He was wide open, you know, on the right side as they were going from left to right, you know, on the field.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I don't think he's alone with it happens to every quarterback. I mean, we're talking about Cousins throwing the first time, I think, ever 4 picks in a game, which, you know, lost that game. And who knows what's going to happen to the Falcons this week. I did want to ask you, getting back to Jackson, when you talk about the running, Hurts was the same way. And I think most young quarterbacks are the same way. I mean, I don't see it with Bo Nix. I don't see it with a couple of other ones. But I think also there, you know, it takes a special coach. We were talking about this with the NFL in general. What's amazing about the Broncos is they are eating half of Russell Wilson's salary this year. So just think of the tap that is putting on the cap this year and next year, and they're amazing. I'll tell you, Don, when you were talking about a team that's won 8 games, or, you know, I guess Mike was talking about the Commanders. Well, I think the Broncos, they weren't picked to do anything this year. And that shows you what a great coach can do when you get a young quarterback and you're committed to him.
Yeah, I mean, when you get a really good young quarterback and you could stretch that out across the 5 years and pay them, you know, well below the league average for even a median quarterback, you know, that adds, you know, a layer of talent to your team that you can spread, you know, in other directions. So, I mean, how important is it to draft the right players and develop the right players and, you know, supplement those with free agents that are reasonably priced, you know, to build that salary cap. And you're talking about another situation that certainly doesn't break my heart, but in Cleveland, you know, they owe Deshaun Watson $73 million this year and next year. And if you listen to, because when I listen to 105.7, they have other reports of other, you know, AFC North teams or whatever, and they talk about Cleveland, and the guy that came on was talking about, you know, how embarrassing is this going to be, basically, if you either go with Jameis Winston or a young rookie quarterback that you draft, and you're going to have, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to just eat the money and cut Watson? Or is he going to be a $73 million backup? Or, like, what's coming down the pike for them in terms of how expensive that is, you know? And then, you know, like you were saying about the Broncos eating, you know, Russell Wilson's contract, and, you know, gosh, there's a lot of money left on that table for a lot of teams, you know?
Oh, boy, is there ever. I mean, it's really incredible now when you see the amount of dollars. 65-50 right now with 11 minutes to go in the game at the Dean Dome, and North Carolina is trailing by 15 at home. That's a little unusual, too. And we'll follow the progress of that one as the show goes on. But I think one of the things that about Bo, maybe you noticed it, too, and that would be he throws a hard ball. Boy, I mean, if you're going to have wide receivers, you better have guys with great hands. because it's like Rodgers. I mean, Rodgers throws, even now, 40 years old, when you watch him play, he throws bullets. And that's what Nix does. He throws bullets. And if you can't catch them, you better go to another team.
Well, imagine catching passes from Brett Favre in 25-degree weather when he was in his heyday. I mean, you see a lot of those wide receivers when they talk, like, on camera as announcers, and their fingers are bent. You know what I mean? Like, their hands are permanently scarred. Look at Booger McFarland, the defensive guy that used to play for Tampa Bay that's on ESPN. His hands are, like, disfigured. His fingers, like, point in different directions. You know what I mean? So it's unbelievable.
Chuck Bednarik.
There you go.
And you're exactly right, Roger. Chuck Bednarik. I sat next to him in a press box for years. And Chuck Bednarik's first finger went dead left, and his middle fourth finger went dead right. I mean, it was unbelievable.
It was. Doug, I want to ask you real quick before we go. You mentioned about the Deshaun Watson. When does that contract – it's like a lifetime contract, correct?
Well, it was fully guaranteed. All of it was fully guaranteed, and they have two remaining years.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. Mm-hmm. So it was fully guaranteed for the life of the contract.
It was
not where he could go.
260, I think it was, fully guaranteed. Might have been more than that.
That answers the question.
Yeah, but the cap hit for over the course of the next 2 years is – right about $73 million per. So, I mean, that's
and then it's over with, and he's gone.
Yep. But, I mean, it's they don't have a choice at this point but to pay the guy, and it's going to reflect
on the
bottom
guaranteed line.
And, you know, and he was playing bad enough that it's a mess for them to have to sort through that to figure out what they're going to do. I mean, you'll see – you know, like the Ravens had signed Marcus Williams two years ago, and he's been a healthy scratch over the course of the last several games, making whatever he was, $19 million a year, whatever it was. You know, the guy they just traded for, Deontay Johnson, they suspended him for one game because apparently he was supposed to go into the game on Sunday and refused to go into the game. So they
– oh, jeez.
He must have been a malcontent in both Pittsburgh and Carolina, because both teams basically gave him away for nothing. So, you know, obviously we didn't have that scouting report when we traded for him. I mean, his talent is pretty good, but if he's going to be a problem in the locker room and, you know, amongst the players, then that's, you know, can't have that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And
well,
if
Roger
can handle things, it's Mike Tomlin. Yeah, he's the best.
Roger, Connecticut up by a bucket with, 22 seconds to go in that game?
Yeah, up by 7.9.
Yeah, break their losing streak. Our resident professional, PGA professional, can you explain to me, and I try to read as much as I can on leave and on the PGA, what the heck are they, what are they doing? I mean, Tiger has a big thing in the paper today about, you know, he's not going to play until he thinks he's ready to play, if ever he's ready to play again in this kind of competition. And he's a big part of the negotiating committee working on resolving this problem. What are they trying to do? I don't understand it.
The only thing I had seen on the bottom of the screen for ESPN was that he had had his sixth back surgery. And all the rest of what you said is true with regard to, I guess he turns 48 or 49 here. 49, I think, this month. So, but I didn't hear anything beyond any kind of resolutions or what was happening. And to be honest with you, I hadn't followed a whole lot of the golf stuff. You know, I mean, I think I'm more focused on baseball free agency and the Orioles. Obviously, we're immersed in football season, both college and pro. I'm probably more apt to bet on a horse than I am really anything else at this time of year.
Well, how about the Orioles? Have they made any kind of – I haven't seen anything really definitive about the Orioles.
Apparently, they were a legitimate suitor for Blake Snell before he re-signed or signed with the Dodgers or whatever.
Dodgers.
You know, but, you know, we're focused on Burns and Santander, and I think the linchpin is going to be Soto, and they're talking about a contract north of $600 million to get his
services.
Well,
we'll leave it there. We'll pick it up next week and pick up all the – latest golf news, as well as we'll know what Soda's doing. Thank you very much, Doug, as always.
Yep. You got it.
Thanks to all our guests along the way. Our executive producer, Frank Carroll, will close it all out. Take care, Frank.
Thanks, Don. Ladies and gentlemen, these programs are brought to you each and every night of the week in grateful appreciation. The men and women of the United States Armed Forces, men and women, police and fire services. When you're out there, you see somebody in uniform, please show some respect. Give them a wink or handshake wherever you can. And these programs are dedicated to those who lost their lives in the line of duty. Deputy Robert Anthony Carroll, Patrolman Jeffrey Kolkap, Patrolman David Curtis, Patrolman Jeffrey Yazowitz, Sergeant Thomas Bainger, San Diego Officer Mike Hendler, Detective Randy Bell, Detective Ricky Childers, Sergeant Tom Wilson, Charlotte County Sheriff's Department, Patrolman Charlie Condit, Tarpon Springs Police Department, Deputy Chief Mike Godwin, Philadelphia Fire Department, Lieutenant Joyce Craig Lewis, Philadelphia Fire Department, Chief Al Hogo, Longboat Key Police Department, Sergeant Chris Levake, Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Mike Zerba, Newcastle County Police, Patrolman Anafa Chris from Lakeland PD, Deputy Josh Meyer, Nassau County Sheriff's Department, Captain Matt Letourneau, Philadelphia Fire Department, Captain Chris Leach, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Ardeth Hope, Wilmington Fire Department, Lieutenant Jerry Ficus, Wilmington Fire Department, Chief Jimmy Ford, Wilmington Fire Department, Deputy Mike Hargrove, Pinellas County Sheriff's Department, Deputy Chelsea Richards, Trooper Chelsea Richards, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Joe Bullock, Florida Highway Patrol, Trooper Zachary Ben, Florida Highway Patrol, Sergeant Chris Fitzgerald, Philadelphia Police Department, Sergeant Armando Manez, Philadelphia Police Department, Fire Chief Corey Compatier, Buffalo Creek Fire Department, and Deputy Rahi Rajnan, Manatee County Sheriff's Department. My brothers and sisters, although you may be 10-7 at this point in time, sometime we'll be 10-10 at the table of the Lord. Until that time, may the rays be up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the rains fall softly on your fields, the sun shine lightly on your face. Until we meet again, may the good Lord keep you and your family always in the hollow of his hands. Good night, God bless, and have a great week. Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. County Dispatch to 1999. All units be advised, 1999 responded to his last emergency. May God rest his soul and all the souls of the faithful departed. Good night, Bob. We love you and we miss you.